From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The actor and director Brian Vaughn says the moment in the play Henry V, where the king calls his soldiers a band of brothers, he says that's Shakespeare's greatest speech. And when you hear it, as you often do with soaring music, you think the play is about war. But when you see the violence and the treachery in other parts of the play, you could think it's actually more anti-war. But Vaughn says, actually, it's neither. Really, he says, it's more about theater. Shakespeare has Henry trying on these different roles, a politician, a warrior, a king. It's about conflict. And it's not just the contest on a battlefield, but the tension going on in Henry's mind. Today in the program, we're live in Cedar City at the Utah Shakespeare Festival, talking about the dramatic story of King Henry V. After the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Hey, all you Game of Thrones fans, you're not the first to be sucked in by a series about power and war that's packed with blood and betrayal. More than 400 years ago, Elizabethan audiences were following the story of Henry in Shakespeare's history plays. When they first met him, in Henry IV, Part 1, he's Prince Hal. He's rebellious and reckless, hanging out with the wrong crowd, wanting nothing to do with his ambitious politician of a father, the king. But over the course of three plays, Prince Hal becomes Henry V. The actor and director Brian Vaughn says Henry is playing different parts, different roles, trying to figure out who he really is. And as we come to the last in the series, the play, Henry V, which is now at the Utah Shakespeare Festival, Henry has accepted this new role as king, but he's still working out just what that means. Today in the program, we're broadcasting from the Shakespeare Festival in Cedar City, talking about Henry V. Brian Vaughn is with us, as I said, co-artistic director of the Utah Shakespeare Festival. He directs Henry V. He's an actor, as a lot of you probably know. He's played, I'm not even going to go down the list of roles that he's played. There are a lot of them. He's played the title role of Henry V himself during 22 seasons with the company. And Brian Vaughn, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Sam Ashdown is with us. He plays Henry V in this season's production. He also played Prince Hal in the festival's other productions of Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, which we'll talk about. And Sam Ashdown, welcome to you.
Yeah, thank you.
We also have with us James Mardock, who is a Shakespeare scholar, the editor of Broadview Press edition of Henry V. It includes an extensive introduction to the play. James Mardock is an associate professor of English and a distinguished professor of the humanities at the University of Nevada, Reno. He's joining us today from public radio station KUNR in Reno. And Professor Mardock, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. And hello to Sam and Brian and everybody else.
Hi, yeah, there's a lot of people here.
Yeah, and as far as they know, I'm wearing a tweed jacket.
We all thought he was. Okay, so I guess the question, first of all, is, and I should just mention how you deal with spoilers. So in most of Shakespeare's plays, the ending has been given away like centuries ago. But there may be those who are here or who are planning on coming to the performance in Cedar City who don't know exactly what happens. Maybe you didn't see the films, there have been a few, and you may not want to hear about it. So we'll warn you maybe about some of these spoiler moments, but we're just going to plow ahead. Is that cool with you guys?
Totally.
Yeah.
Okay. I wanted to begin, Brian Vaughn, would you mind, because I think a lot of people are like, oh, I know everything about Henry V. A lot of us don't. Give us a sense of what, you don't have to go through everything, but give us a sense of what's happening in Henry V.
Well, Henry V picks up basically right after Henry IV, Part 2, and the play begins with basically Henry recently sitting on the throne, and the kingdom in a little bit of uncertainty, and especially from the church and how Henry's relationship with the church is being forged, as well as Henry basically battling his own uncertainty of his legitimacy of now inheriting the throne of England. The play begins with the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Bishop of Ely talking about how Henry will begin to tax the church, and and get their funds. And the church basically has this moment where they say, you know, there's this particular incident, the Salic Law, that there is legitimacy for Henry to invade France to establish his own legitimacy and essentially to put the money elsewhere to keep him from taxing the church.
Right.
It's a, in many ways, a calculated move on both parts. You scratch our back, we'll scratch yours type of thing. And they put this out there. Then Henry gets a message from the Dauphin, the French Dauphin, who's the prince, that basically is an insult towards him and his own legitimacy on the throne, a gift of tennis balls, yeah. he says. And Henry then says, we are indeed moving into France, and we will turn those tennis balls into cannonballs. And then the play begins moving forward with a campaign with Henry moving into France and particularly outnumbered going into France and the journey that he goes on in trying to find his own sense of self in the role as well as him trying to unify his nation behind a cause. That's one sort of, that's a very broad overview of what's going on. The play is also really about, I think, the journey of a young man and his establishing of self and finding an authentic sense of self in the journey. The play is also a great love letter to the theater in that, we have this great device in the play of the chorus yeah. who comes out and basically says, use your imagination and go with us to go on this journey, that on this stage we will unfold great epic battles and many different soldiers and warfare that only the theater can do. And I think this is really a vessel into what's going on with Henry also, of him himself being the key actor in this role, which is adopting many different roles in an effort to find the true role, which is himself as the king, and what that means about him leading the nation as himself and not trying to emulate those around him, and essentially, specifically, his father before him.
Yeah.
So that's sort of what the play is about. It's very, also I think a very pro-English play, but also deals with a lot of great elements of hypocrisy and back and forth about motivation and yeah. his motives in doing it. And it's certainly very relevant for today.
Yeah. We'll get to all that because it's pretty remarkable how complicated and complex all the sort of politics can be in it. But talk, Brian Vaughan, about Sam Ashdown's role. You've had him, this is now, he's been playing this role. He was in Henry the Fourth, Part One, Part Two, and now this role. And you've talked about how that was conscious on your part. You wanted him to really develop this role in that way. Is that unique, by the way? That's pretty interesting.
It is unique for our festival. That's the first time that that's ever happened. A lot of it, I'll be perfectly honest, is, you know, I had the great opportunity to play Prince Hal in the 90s. I was like, how cool would it have been to be able to do Part One and then Part Two and then Henry V? And
yeah.
Me as the actor, you know, this sort of really eager young man. And then as a producer, I said, well, this is a really unique opportunity both for Sam to play this role over the course of three plays, as well as for our audience to see it unfold with the same actor, that there can begin to be relationship with Sam, but specifically with the character and that journey. And that also happened not only with Sam, but also with Larry Bull,
yeah.
who played Bolingbroke in Richard II, and then played Henry IV, and then he is also playing the chorus in our production. That is intentional on our part, because the play is about fathers and sons, and it is about the inheritance of the sin of the father and how the son deals with that. So having a really powerful, specific point of view coming from the same two people over the course of time was definitely on purpose, and I think has been beautiful for me because I've established a great relationship with them, and we've all been able to really dive into the play with a great deal of energy and excitement.
Well, Sam Ashdown, it means that you come to this role not already prepared, but you've got a lot to work with because you've done the other two plays. What was it like?
Yeah, I mean, it's been an incredible experience for me. I feel so lucky, first of all, to be able to play this guy for 3 years, And also get to work with Brian Vaughn on all three of these plays. It's been interesting to be able to do the plays one at a time and then step away and sort of keep the character in the room as you go through life and as you grow up and experiences happen to you, and then come back to him. It's been, really special.
Okay, I want to bring James Murdoch into this conversation because I want to talk about 1599. This is when he writes, we think, Henry V. But he also happens to have written, get this, Julius Caesar, As You Like It, all in 1599. Hamlet, and then he finishes Much Ado About Nothing. James Murdoch, what is going on in 1599? This is like this burst of creativity.
What's going on for Shakespeare is that he's having really a wonder year. But what's going on in London around him is really interesting as well. There are veterans in the streets, veterans of Elizabeth's wars. It's not by any means clear that all of Shakespeare's audiences would have had the same pro-war, jingoistic view of nationalism and invading France, as the chorus sometimes seems to voice. There is a foreign war going on at the moment in 1599 with the Earl of Essex leading an army into Ireland, not France, but Ireland. And in fact, the play Henry V refers to that campaign in Ireland and asks you to compare the possibility of Essex returning home victorious to the picture of Henry returning home victorious from France that appears in the play. Now, famously, Essex kind of made a terrible mess of the campaign in Ireland and came home and was accused of treason and trying to overthrow the throne. So things didn't go very well for Essex, and probably that's why later productions of the play cut out the chorus, because they didn't want Shakespeare to get in trouble for having said nice things about Essex. But yeah, exactly. The thing that Brian mentioned about this play being about fathers and sons, Shakespeare's very much into the idea of fathers and sons. He's actually, he's got a sick son of his own who will die in the ensuing months after this. He's writing Julius Caesar, which is about Brutus, a young man being haunted by the ghost of a father figure that he has killed, Julius Caesar. He's got As You Like It, which is a play about fathers and daughters and also fathers and sons. It's got a son in it being haunted by the memory of his daughter, of his father. And then you've got Henry V, which is about a son, Hal, now Henry V, being haunted by the memory of his father. And especially perhaps one line from the deathbed speech, or one of the deathbed speeches of Henry IV, where he says, you know how to rule well? You know how to keep yourself from rebellion at home? Busy, giddy minds with foreign quarrels. That is to say, if you've seen, like the audience at Utah Shakes has seen, to Henry IV, what you notice about Henry V is that this is a continuation of a particular kind of ruling policy that Henry's father actually handed down to him. Go to France, that will keep people's mind off anything that's going wrong at home. This sounds very familiar to us today, especially after the last, say, 15 years of American history, I suppose.
Right.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah,
I could just go on like
no,
this.
No, I'm sure
for,
you could,
forever.
And we will. We'll try to for the next. I guess we should also mention Hamlet, who's haunted by his father.
About to get to that.
Yeah.
He's sort of famously haunted by his father as well.
What's interesting about the connection between Henry V, I noticed, is that Hamlet is trying to make this transition from uncertainty and self-doubt to become a man of action. Henry V, Brian Vaughn, the same way.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, that's essentially what is going on in these plays, that it is the sense of living an authentic sense of self and not trying to be something that you're not. Hamlet has it at the final moments of the play where he says, if it be now, it is not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all. Since no man of aught he leaves knows what is to leave betimes, let be. That sense is basically living in the now of all things. And Henry goes through the same journey of him trying to emulate his father's footsteps in a campaign that he is grossly outnumbered for, and how he is going to lead people behind him in trying to rally the nation. And you see that in the play with the Irish and Scottish and Welsh, English, all these sort of factions that he's trying to bring together behind a cause. But the main thing that he has to do is come to a conclusion and an awakening of self before he can do that. And that doesn't happen until the eve of the battle, where he has this beautiful speech about upon the king.
Yep.
What is that? And he says, no, 'tis not the balm, the scepter, the mace. It is not all that. And the very end of that speech, he says, the day my friends and all things stay for me. And that me is a sense of the authentic person of himself. And from that, he launches...
Wait, is he saying rally around? I figured this out. This is who I am. Rally around me.
Yes, I'm not going to try to be something that I'm not. It's going to come from me. And the very next moment we see him in the play, he comes with the greatest speech in Shakespeare, which is a complete selfless speech, which is the St. Crispin speech, which becomes about those around him.
Yeah.
And it flows from him in a way that becomes real and that people get behind. That awakening happens in this play, just as it happens in Hamlet, just as it happens in Julius Caesar with Brutus, just as it happens in Much Ado About Nothing with Beatrice and Benedict. This sense of an awakening of people in extreme situation where they go, you know what? This is who I am, and now I need to move forward. So I don't think that that writer would be writing about that stuff unless something was going on with him about trying to find that. And I think that that message in this play, even though it is a history play, is extremely human, and that is why we keep coming back to them. That you can relate to this, even though I've never been in war, I've never been in the military, but I can relate to somebody going, okay, how am I going to live my day-to-day life as who I am? And that's what he's going with.
Yeah.
And it also comes with a guy who is trying to adopt an ideology of God and a selfless sense of purpose. And that's hard to do when his father before him was completely paranoid about that.
Yeah.
go ahead. Can I interject?
Yeah, of course.
I really, really love that interpretation, especially of the upon the king speech on the eve of battle as his turning point, because, of course, it's entirely about theater, right? It's not the balm, the scepter, and the ball. It's not props. It's not costumes. It's not the audience members around him that define him. And it's especially noteworthy about this play because, Sam, I'm sure you noticed this, given the role of Hal in Henry IV plays, you do occasionally get soliloquies where you get to let yourself go, talk to the audience. And what's more, you've got a posse, right? You've got Falstaff and the rest of your posse in the Henry IV plays, and those have all been stripped away from you.
Right.
That speech in Henry V, where he says, let everything fall upon the king, that is his only soliloquy in the play.
Right.
It must feel, I mean, I've never played, unlike you guys, I've never had the opportunity to play Henry V, but I imagine that coming off of Henry IV, it feels as though a lot of your support has been stripped away, and you've got a different relationship with an audience in the first, at least in the first half of the play, in which every speech that Henry has, he's forced to play to a different kind of audience to achieve some different kind of effect.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the thing about this play is it starts just shot out of a cannon. I mean, it starts with waging war on France. And in every scene, Henry is doing something and the stakes are really high. So we talk about that sense of finding yourself and finding the authentic version. He's trying to do that while he's, you know, speaking to a messenger from France to wage war on France. So the stakes are huge and he doesn't have time to reflect or to talk to the audience until that night, until the Upon the King speech, which is his first time to sort of breathe. And it's interesting that comes after he puts on this cloak and hides himself from those around him. It's almost like he has to hide being king to find the sense of where he's really at.
I want to ask you about like the manipulation part of the play. Brian, as you mentioned right at the beginning, Henry V is being manipulated. He probably knows it because he wants something too, but you get a sense that a lot of these speeches that he's delivering are not just about unification and patriotism. They're also a little bit of manipulation. And I wanted to have you talk about Henry as a complicated figure, because it's interesting if you look at Olivier's Henry V, the film that he did, I think this was during World War II, he strips out some of the uglier sections of Henry V and makes him just a kind of, I won't say one-dimensional character, but he takes out a war crime. We'll get to that because I think that's complicated. But you guys say something about that is he's a really complicated character. There's moments when you're like, yes, I'll go with you anywhere, and wait a minute, you're just sort of manipulating the grunts.
Yeah, I mean, that's something obviously that's been written about, too, with a lot of scholarship on Henry, and which I find interesting also in parallel with Hamlet is, like, who are you? Who is this guy? You know, I mean, that's the very first line of Hamlet, who's there?
Yep.
And it's similar to this, is you don't really get inside who Henry is in this play until he's pushed to the brink at the battle, the eve before, where you get that soliloquy that Sam talked about, which I think was really accurate. And, it is complicated. And I think it's a young man who's inheriting complication also. A kingdom before him that was taxed endlessly by his father, trying to keep these opposing factions at bay. And the country was in great turmoil, great disarray, that all of a sudden it's yours. Now go. You're the king. And at the heart of that is him going, am I really king?
Yeah.
Do I have the legitimate right in a divine right of king's world to really be sitting on this throne? And that's the sort of moral thing that's going alongside him, I think, in this journey. He's also very isolated in the play, very isolated. All of the scenes you see him with are very big. You see these big speeches. You know, you have the tennis ball speech, and then you have the once more unto the breach scene, or the traitor scene, and then you have the breach scene. They're big, sort of isolated moments where he's not really, he's connecting to a certain degree, but not on an intimate level with them, until he does that moment where he puts on the mask, puts on this role of being, I'll be somebody else, to try to get an opinion about how I am, who I am.
And so that's when he becomes, at least in his own mind, now I'm really sincere. Now this is who I am. He's not pretending anymore.
I think so. And I think some of that complication comes from someone who is at great uncertainty about being going forward with the campaign, trying to unify. Doubt.
Yeah.
The play is about doubt and overcoming doubt. And at the core of that is somebody who is wrestling with that. And the messiness in the play that does happen and that could be construed the other direction, and I have certainly seen productions where he could become very Machiavellian and very manipulative and harsh and shrewd, could be there. I don't think that's necessarily what's at play here in this play.
Yeah.
I think it's somebody who is taking action and sometimes makes the wrong choice. And I think that in itself is very accurate. And also, you see that with all these other characters that we're talking about in this, that they have parts of them that are not really redeemable, or they're questionable. And it's how he deals with that.
Sam, how do you see that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that I'm also playing Mark Antony this summer out here. And the thing that's really similar between Mark Antony and Henry to me is that they get things done, that they're effective in what they set out to do. And I think that it's really easy then to reflect and say, well, is it moral what they do, or is it right, or is it just? And I don't know, but I do know that they accomplish what they set out to at the beginning. And I think that Henry is doing a lot in each of these speeches and in each of these scenes. And I do think that there's this stripping away throughout the play, because things are going really horribly for Henry as he's trying to do them. And so he's forced to get further and further down to who he really is at the core as the play goes on.
There's a moment in this speech where he says, I think the king is but a man.
Yeah.
Now, he's disguised when he says it, but James Murdoch, maybe we can talk to you about this as well, because this seems like a big deal, especially in the context of a place that believes in the divine right of kings. It seems like that kind of political landscape is shifting, maybe?
The political landscape, I mean, you can read certain lines in this play as deeply disturbing and deeply subversive. For a monarchist audience, or at least an ostensibly monarchist audience, a lot of the particular lines are really potentially disturbing. The opening chorus has the line, "For 'tis your thoughts that now must deck our kings," which I think is a remarkable line, because what it acknowledges is that kingship is just a matter of the communal construction of an identity, right? The audience looks at Dick Burbage, a carpenter, and says, okay, we agree for the next 2 hours that he's the King of England. And how is that any different from what the audience is doing with Queen Elizabeth? Or indeed what Britons today are doing with the other Queen Elizabeth?
So would he have gotten in trouble for that?
Well, he didn't.
Yeah.
And this is something that runs through all of Shakespeare's histories, really, and all of his tragedies as well. The idea that statecraft is really aligned closely to theater.
Yeah.
You see this in Richard III, where he's actually explicitly saying, I'm going to act out a role, and they're going to believe me. Now, of course, in Richard III, that's the villain. In Henry V, it's a, well, ambiguously, possibly a little bit troubling national hero who's doing all of this. When he says, the king is but a man as I am, it is a remarkable moment. And that whole scene with Bates, Court, and Williams, when the king is in disguise and is going around to, you know, see what the men think of him and think of his war, is remarkable in many, many ways. But one of the ways that it's remarkable is that the soldiers are not convinced by his performance. Sort of for the first time in the play, somebody's not really convinced by him. They say, it's going to be a heavy reckoning for the king that led us to this if the cause is not good. And the king says, it has a very long speech, at least on the page. It's kind of messy logic. The king says, oh, you're saying that the, well, let's see, William says, the king is responsible for all of our lives. And Henry says, more or less, oh no, the king is not responsible for all of your souls.
Yeah.
Right.
That's where it really gets to be about conscience, too.
Yeah.
Like, how much of this do we put on the, because the soldiers are wondering, look, if we do this thing, and let's say it goes overboard, is God going to judge us for that? And that's really on their minds, you can tell. And Henry's trying to work it out with them. Sam, what do you think about that speech?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to this really core question of how can you be a king? How can a man be a king? How can this guy lead this country and answer for all these lives, all these souls, all these children, all these debts? You know, he lists all these things. How can this all rest upon one person? And how can you lead a country from, like Brian says, this authentic sense of self, when all that's weighing on you? And he's seen, you know, Richard II do it in a way that was ineffective, and he's seen his father be, you know, destroyed by the crown that he has to wear. And so he's trying to figure out, how is he going to do this? How can he do this? And I do think that it's comes from an insecure place when he says, no, it can't, it's not my fault, it can't rest on the king. That seems like such a human response to someone saying, you know, the king is going to have to answer for everything wrong that happens to, you know, all our soldiers, but also our country. I mean, that's so much for one man. How can one person bear that?
That's Sam Ashdown. He plays Henry V in the Utah Shakespeare Festival performance of Henry V. Brian Vaughn is co-artistic director of the festival, directs the production. James Murdoch is with us. He teaches English and at the University of Nevada, Reno, editor of Broadview Press's edition of the play. Henry V runs through September 10th here at the festival in Cedar City. You can find links and more information on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're live at the Utah Shakespeare Festival in Cedar City, talking about King Henry V. It's a play a lot of us know about. It has that soaring speech where Henry urges his soldiers, his band of brothers, into battle, facing impossible odds. The play's director, Brian Vaughn, says it isn't really a play about war. It's a play about going to war. And even more, he says, it's about an internal battle, about a person's conscience, when honor comes up against ambition and pride. Brian Vaughn is with us, co-artistic director of the festival, director of the production. Sam Ashdown plays Henry. He's with us. And James Mardock with us from the University of Nevada, Reno. He is teaches English there. And Henry V runs through September 10th. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later. Sam Ashdown, let me ask you, how bloody was the Battle of Agincourt, that real battle?
Yeah, well, we talked about this in rehearsals. You know, the real Battle of Agincourt is a little different than Shakespeare's version in the play. I mean, it's true that the English were way outnumbered. I mean, the numbers differ. It's the French or the English that are saying how much they were outnumbered by.
Yeah, that's right.
But they were definitely outnumbered. But, I mean, when I did a little bit of research on it, the thing that struck me about the real battle was just how messy and awkward it was. It was incredibly muddy, and the French were wearing these 60-pound armors on, and they were trudging through the mud, and the English were exhausted, starving, sick. A lot of them didn't have shoes or trousers at that point because they were so sick and beat up. And you just get this sense of it just being this slow, clunky, messy battle where a lot of the French soldiers drowned, actually, in the mud and didn't even make it to the front lines. And then the soldiers would push on top of them and push on top of them. And it was this horrific, really awkward, muddy battle.
Yeah.
Shakespeare paints a little bit of a different picture.
Yeah. He gives the English version.
He gives the English version, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And he takes out the longbow, which was crucial to the English victory.
Although we do see that in the play.
Yeah.
That's cool, Brian.
Yeah, I put that in because it's such a specific element of that battle that that's what won the battle for,
It's
for
truly
English.
Remarkable that Shakespeare removes the longbow because everybody in that audience would have been aware that the English won that battle because of this technological advantage that they had. The English won every battle they won in the Hundred Years' War because of that technological advantage until the French came up with cannons,
Exactly.
And right. there were ballads at the time the play was running, talking about Agincourt, and they entirely focus on how great this perfect English invention the longbow was.
Yeah.
Shakespeare completely cuts it out, and I'm not sure why. I mean, obviously, you can't shoot a lot of arrows in a theater.
You can pretend you are. Brian did it.
Yeah, that's true. One of the things that it does is it removes the lower class, the yeoman class, the archers, who actually won the battle, and allows the play to focus on Henry, on Henry's cousin, who sacrifices himself in hand-to-hand combat. It lets them focus on the chivalric sort of King Arthur sword-to-sword combat. And I'd be interested to hear what you guys think about that. And Brian actually putting the longbows back in is a serious critical decision about the play. That makes a big difference, I think.
Well, that raises a question for me. I do want you to talk about that, because it seems like the St. Crispin speech is about him getting into the mud with the guys. Is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think so.
Yeah.
I think that whole thing is about, he. I love that line where he says, those that have no stomach for this fight, let him depart. Their passport shall be made, and crowns for convoy put in their purse. We would not die in that man's company that fears his fellowship to die with us. Then he's basically saying, go away. If you want to get money, I'll pay you money to leave. But what I want is people here present to knowing that this could be a monumental moment for all of us. And it's tremendous rhetoric happening here, to rally them here. But and it look, is rousingly what you effective.
Say, you think it's the greatest speech Shakespeare wrote?
I do. I mean, that and To Be or Not to Be, I think, are just these amazing speeches. This one especially because it's extremely active in what it's doing to those around him. And I think it is immediately resonant for us as a society about being in a situation where we are pushed to the brink, about stepping outside of that together.
Yeah.
Together. We are the sum of all of our parts. And he doesn't really... He doesn't have a whole lot of that in a lot of his plays, where it really becomes not about the king. Most of his kings are really, really kind of selfishly woven, if you look at them. And this is a guy who's saying, it's not about me, it's about us. And I think that that is powerful. And I think the Band of Brothers, that idea, you know, we see that today. We see it in cinema. We see it on television, of that notion of our veterans who are trying to overcome great odds. And it really has an immediacy to it that is very, very profound. So I do think it is one of his greatest speeches.
Is it terrifying to have to give one of the most iconic speeches there is? Like, Sam, as an actor, and Brian, you can speak to this, obviously, too.
I'll let Sam take that one. It's,
yes, I mean, the answer is yes.
And do you ever look into the audience and people are, like, mouthing the words? They know that, I mean, this is a very... talk about how you approached that, like, it's so iconic. Everyone knows it. Do I treat it differently? I mean, how are you thinking about it as an actor?
Yeah, it is iconic. I mean, Brian, when we were rehearsing it, Brian gave me this great direction, which was... just to let it be present with these actors, these soldiers on stage this time. And just because, I mean, also that's what the character is doing. The character is being present in a way that he hasn't for the up until that point in the play. And so to just embrace that as an actor and decide to be present and let the speech, I don't know, be what it is this time right now with these people is how I go into it. But yes, it is terrifying.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I mean, I also think it's truly one of the most magnificent things about being an actor, being handed this material, knowing that all of the footsteps that you're walking in doing this, and knowing that the greatest actors of our time have had the same fear of those that went before them. And what's so great about it is it forces you to just make it you.
Yeah.
And that is what is brilliant about what Shakespeare is also putting in this play, about theater and life blending in together. The actor himself is going through exactly what the character is going through, about being present to it happening in the moment every single time. And that is a very meta thing,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That as an actor is extremely engaging and thrilling, yeah. You know. It forces you to get over your own fear also, right. When there's 900 people looking at you. Don't judge me. This is how it's going to go.
Brian,
can I be a friendly contrarian?
Yes, of course.
I agree absolutely with you that this is, if not the best, one of the best speeches in Shakespeare.
One of the best.
I just want to remind everybody, though, that the idea that Henry is in that speech addressing the troops is a tradition that comes from the theater and is not actually in the play. He certainly is addressing his cousins, Westmoreland, Salisbury, York, Bedford. These are the people that he names as.
But these are the nobles.
Yeah, the nobles, exactly.
Yeah.
In the 19th century, Charles Kean put 180 actual actors with cannons and spears on stage so that he could address them. In the Olivier movie, of course, Olivier gets off his horse, stands on a cart, and talks to all of the troops who say hooray. In the Kenneth Branagh movie, Branagh, channeling Olivier, gets off of his horse, stands on a cart, and says it to all of the troops who say hooray. But the fact that in the speech, in the line that you just mentioned about proclaiming it throughout the host that he who has no stomach for this fight, let him depart, Henry says, Westmoreland, go tell the troops that. Go proclaim it through all my host. Which suggests that maybe he's not talking to everybody, that maybe he's talking to his literal band of brothers, his nobles, his countrymen, his people. Earlier on in the other also famous Once More Into the Breach speech, he very carefully distinguishes between the English nobles and the English yeomanry, whom he calls grosser men of grosser blood. Be copy now to men of grosser blood and teach them how to war. Later on, after the Battle of Agincourt, he very carefully distinguishes between the French who died, who were nobles, and the French who died that were just grunts. And he does the same thing with the English. So there's a strain in this play, and I absolutely love to see productions of the play that speak to my, you know, democratic modern ideology, that make the us that he's talking to absolutely everybody regardless of class. That's not necessarily the only way to read it. It's a perfectly good way to read it. But for example, in the 1980s, the English Shakespeare Company did it, and other productions have done it this way as well, where Michael Pennington as Henry came into what was basically a glum officer's tent and spoke that speech to about six guys, all of whom reacted positively to it, but there was no sense that it was democratizing, as other productions have done.
James Murdoch is with us. He teaches English at the University of Nevada, Reno. Sam Ashdown plays Henry. Brian Vaughn, co-artistic director of the festival, he directs the production of Henry V, which runs through September 10th here at the Utah Shakespeare Festival in Cedar City. You can find information about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to a conversation about Henry V. We're at live at the Utah Shakespeare Festival talking about the production of Henry V. We have with us Brian Vaughn, co-artistic director of the festival, who directs the production of Henry V. Sam Ashdown plays Henry. James Murdoch teaches English at the University of Nevada, Reno. So I felt disappointed in King Henry that he ditches all his old friends, ditches Sir John Falstaff, who doesn't even appear in this play, which I found really interesting. Although it's a really lovely, lovely speech from the woman who's caring for him, talking about his final moments. And maybe we can talk about that, because I think that's a beautiful moment. Gets rid of Bardolph and Nym, and Pistol escapes. He basically, I don't want to say abandons, but what do you make of that? Is he just sort of, I mean, they were rabble-rousers. He's now stepped into this role as king, so it makes sense that he doesn't want to be a rowdy penny, you know, basically pickpocket anymore. But it also seems sort of just mean.
And Shakespeare clearly wants us to feel it, too, right? It would have been so easy to write this play and just not include any of those characters, but they're in, like, every other scene.
Yep.
So that you notice, oh, he's really not paying attention to these people. And sometimes he's letting them die.
Well, and not only that, I thought that the people in the bear-baiting pits watching this play, the Elizabethan audience, they had an affinity for those guys. Mm-hmm. And seeing him sort of dismiss them, banish Sir John, literally have Bardolph and Nym killed, yeah, that was interesting. What do you guys make of that? Brian, what do you think?
Well, I first off, I think it's definitely intentional on the playwright to do this, because I think he has to turn away his former self to move forward.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is, it's a guy who's also trying to justify right and wrong and how to be an authoritative figure in a world of change. And he says that to these characters in part one. No, if you do this, you will pay the price for your actions, if you do this. And the beautiful irony is that that does happen to Bardolph in Henry V, where he robs from the church. And Henry makes a critical decision to do what he does. I think it's beautifully woven that he does steal from the church,
yeah.
Because I also think that that's what's happening in the play, about a moral right and wrong. And he makes a conscious decision to turn these people away. And what's beautiful also is that you see the boy who was the page of Falstaff that Prince Hal gave to Falstaff kind of as a joke, also going through the same journey that Prince Hal has gone through about a realization of self in a world that might not be the most ideal way to live your life.
Yeah.
And I think one of the most poetic moments in the play is that moment where Quickly says, she describes Falstaff's death, and Falstaff says three words, God, 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 in his final moments. For a character that who has embodied no ideal of that for the past two plays, but has said, give me life, which I will spare, and honor, and all of these things that are infused in Henry. He is two sides of the father, essentially. His father and Falstaff. So it's imperative that these characters are in this play because he relates to their social status and who they are as individuals. However, moving forward, he can't adopt a sensibility that is about crime and debauchery. It's just not the cause. And it's painfully tragic, I think, in the play, but it is also a thread that has woven who he is as an individual. I also think if Falstaff were in this play, it would take the glory away from Henry.
Yeah.
He's just an amazingly written character.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, you know? That's right.
He is life,
yeah.
As he says.
It's interesting, and Sam, I wanted to hear you on this, the role the boy plays. I think the choices you and Brian made, you didn't go beyond the text, but you really made a connection with the boy. It's almost, and it's just a bunch of stage business, the way you react to him. Would you talk about that relationship? Because it's really touching, and I think a unique part of the way you've created this role.
Sure. I mean, I do think, you know, talking about the play being about fathers and sons, I mean, that's the closest thing Hal has to someone that he's mentoring or is, you know, following in possibly his footsteps or possibly not. And I do think there's a real love for the boy. And, you know, as in part two, when Hal is distancing himself from Falstaff, the boy takes that, you know, the place a little bit of Hal for Falstaff. Mm-hmm. It's painful to see what, you know, this boy goes through by going to war. And it's a very immediate, I think, personal thing that Henry sees the effects of his campaign on an individual that he loves, that he cares about. So I think it's a really personal element of the play that I love that we sort of point at and kind of make maybe a little bit more than is in the text. Show that human side of Henry.
I think it's greatly symbolic too, because the boy has grown up with the hostess, who is a mother figure for the boy, essentially, and is having to say goodbye to this world to go to war. And it is a mirror of Hal. Yeah. It is the same thing. The nurturing element that the tavern gave Hal, we see in the boy. But the boy also coming to a moral conflict about that their sense of self. And I find it very Arthurian, too, a little bit, you know, that sort of boy who would be king type thing, that the potential of the boy as a silent observer also, which I think is just an important thing. Maybe that's me as a parent. I don't know. But but it's, I think, significant. In the youth that are represented in all of these plays and moving forward.
We're essentially out of time, but I wanted to ask one final thing. We made reference to the chorus and certainly the prologue at the beginning, referencing this wooden O, referencing the theater. I'm not sure if I have the story exactly right, but in 1599, the Globe was being rebuilt.
The Globe was being built for the first time.
It was being built, right.
Yeah, in 1599, the company made this genius move where they had the lease of the theater building, but they didn't have the rights to the land. So in the middle of the night, they went to the theater, disassembled it, took it across the river, and built it on a new place that they had the lease to. So it's a completely new theater.
Brian Vaughn, Henry V is the first play in this theater. I mean, that's, as you've said, that's a pretty meta.
It is,
moment.
And definitely intentional. You know, that was when we knew we were doing the history plays and we were putting them all in succession, we had this as a target that Henry V would open our new Ingolstadt Shakespeare Theater because of what the chorus says at the beginning of this play, which is, can this cockpit hold the vasty fields of France? That it's resonating on many levels. I remember saying to Larry Bull in rehearsal, I was like, you know, the night you do this on opening night, you just got to live in it, man, and say it, because it's acting on many, many different levels. But it is specific because it's about the theater and about what's going to happen over the next, you know, generations to come in this space, about really kind of infusing and blessing the space with the language and making them work together.
It's Brian Vaughn, co-artistic director of the Utah Shakespeare Festival. He directs the production of Henry V. Sam Ashdown plays Henry. James Mardock teaches English at the University of Nevada, Reno, editor of the Broadview Press edition of the play. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. This has been a blast.
Yeah,
thanks a lot. Henry V runs through September 10th here at the Shakespeare Festival in Cedar City. You can get links to it and information about tickets and all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to James Matthews, Jerry Carpenter, and Michael Karchner, and Cami Paul Terry here at the Shakespeare Festival. Thanks back at the studio in Salt Lake to Tim Slover. The show is directed today by our engineer, Lewis Downey. He's right there. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark. She's right there. And Benjamin Bombard. He's not here. I'm Doug Fabrizio.